Not long ago, there were only three television channels, and the cheaply made family man comedy was king. Turning the dial would only give you another glimpse into a suburban nuclear family with a breadwinner husband, a stay-at-home wife, and the occasional talking horse. That is until 1964, when one show dared to take a glimpse into the lives of terrible monsters that lived next door. The Munsters premiered that September, and well, America has yet to recover. The Munster Hunter shuns the millions of hours of original shows that are available at the press of a button to take a look back at a 60-year-old comedy about a Frankenstein monster and his grotesque family.
He reaches down and he just grabs her by the butt and lifts her up.
Yep. Yeah. Instead of opening the window, he punches through the window. Which, I mean, this is your damn window, man.
By the way, he's trying to catch the raven out of the clock.
Oh, is that what he's doing to feed the cat?
Yeah.
I was very disinterested, to be honest. The Munster Hunters, available every Monday wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I'm Phil Rude, I'm the dad.
And I'm Austin Rude, and what am I?
You're my creation.
Some would call that being a son.
Or some would call it an abomination.
That's right, yeah. I am.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
We like to podcast and watch movies and get on mic and talk about it.
We do like to podcast. We better, because we sure as hell ain't getting paid. Nice try on the Gatorade promotion.
But I did. I mean,
we threw it out there. Gatorade, call us.
Please.
Anyway, we've been off for a little while.
It's been a little hectic here in Florida.
Life has happened a little bit again. Lots happened. Halloween is come and gone. We're outside of the Halloween season. Still doing Halloween movies.
You know, Halloween is all year round if you try. Make an effort.
It's true. And it's more of a state of mind than
that's
a holiday.
Right.
But you did dress as a pregnant minion, which was very exciting.
I wasn't pregnant.
Where did you get your overalls?
I happened to find overalls that fit me perfectly in the women's maternity section of Target, okay? And it worked. I was a minion.
You know, for as long as people have been rallying to take down the gendered sections in maternity, you know, really does sort of still have their own little market cornered over there. They're like, we're the maternity clothes. And yet, you, a non-pregnant man, found a perfect solution to your fashion problems there.
To be fair, anyone can go in any section. And also,
that's true.
Maternity isn't necessarily gendered. I mean, a man can be pregnant.
I'm just saying specifics of, how do I want to word this? Specific demographics of different sections of clothing.
I was outside the intended target audience, but I still made it work.
But
and that was our Halloween, and you dressed up as
a warehouse worker for the school district.
There you go. Yeah,
I was a Halloween Grinch, I guess. I did not celebrate this year. I do appreciate the Halloween season, but for me, it's mostly about watching horror movies, and had a good time with that. I watched a lot of Stephen King stuff this October.
That is valid.
Yeah.
Someone told me about The Stand. She was reading the book The Stand.
Yes, and that The Stand.
I've heard mixed things. She was thrown, someone told her that she would really like The Stand, and then gave her the unedited version.
It's a very big book.
And she is so confused by it, she hates it.
Okay.
So, not to say that it's bad, but the way she described it, I was like, that's really interesting.
I remember the TV miniseries of The Stand And I did not really care for it just because I don't think TV budgets ever treat Stephen King very kindly.
Yeah, that's not.
And that's just a giant book to try to adapt into anything. I think they've been trying to make a stand movie or trilogy or something for a long time. I think nobody can quite get their heads around how to do it. But with the success of like breaking it into two separate movies.
Yeah, they could do that.
I think someone will find a way to do it, which will save me from having to read that enormous book.
Just hearing the plot of it, really curious about what it would be like to read that or see an adaption of it post-COVID. Since it's about post-apocalyptic diseases also, and whatnot.
Post a decade of zombie apocalypse kind of, you know, survivors.
Yeah.
You know, we've watched The Walking Dead is on like its 25th season, I think. They're right up there with The Simpsons. At
Who
this
knows?
Point.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, we're very familiar with that story now. And yes. It probably hits a little bit differently.
Also wanted to throw this out there. I watched the final, I'm going to put that in air quotes, Halloween movie. Halloween Ends.
Please, no spoilers. I still haven't seen it. And despite the mixed reviews, I still very much want to. I want to finish this trilogy.
I'm going to put my spoiler-free review, which is that I think it was really interesting. They were really going for something. And I don't think it worked perfectly, but it worked for me.
Hats off to them for trying, at least.
Yes.
You know?
And better than Halloween Kills.
You know, I figured. Yeah, not a fan, but
it's all right.
Part of it's a watchable movie, for sure. I'm also going to, as long as we're talking about what we've been up to, I'm going to issue a correction in an earlier episode, and I don't even know which one it was. I mentioned that I had watched Dr. Sleep, and I did not care for it. I rewatched it last weekend, and thoroughly enjoyed it. I did a complete 180 on that movie.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
I think once I divorced myself from my expectations for what a sequel to The Shining should be in my mind, and just watch that movie on its own merit and as an expansion of The Shining timeline, storyline, and kind of the expanded universe of The Shining, I enjoyed it very much. And thanks to our buddy Corey Scott, who never gave up hope. He kept encouraging me. He's like, give it another shot because you like Mike Flanagan's work. Mike Flanagan did Midnight Mass and he did Hush. He's done these great horror. He did Gerald's Game. These things that I generally like very much. And he just was always kind of like, if you can find the director's cut, it's even better, which I haven't seen yet. But I did give it another shot, and I really, really did enjoy it. And it made me, it sort of re-energized me to want to read the book and sort of complete the entire Shining universe in my headcanon for it. So
that's really great. Like, because I remember you being excited.
I was very
movie,
dismissive and about it and, after I saw it. And I think just a little bit of time and going, okay, it's not what I expected it to be. Let me try and be open to what this movie is. And it really did help. And it actually kind of is climbing. The more it sinks in with me, the more it's sort of climbing the ranks of my favorite Stephen King adaptations or Stephen All King right. movies. I don't know how it is as an adaptation because
you haven't read that.
It is more of a sequel to the movie. But
is there a book version of it? I thought there was.
Yeah, there is. But it is, spoilers, The Overlook is destroyed in the end of The Shining book. But the Overlook is still standing in the Dr. Sleep movie. So it is,
it's going with the movie.
It is universe. Going with the movie canon, but still being an adaptation, which I don't know how it worked. I haven't read the Dr. Sleep book. Anyway, this All is right. not a Dr. Sleep thing. I did just want to kind of report. I was kind of blown away when, I don't know if it's ever happened to you, where you watch a movie and you feel one way about it and then you rewatch it and you go, oh, I was completely off the first time I saw this. And yeah, I mean,
our first episode on the podcast. Fight Club. I did not care for
Book
it.
Book of Eli, you did a big turnaround on.
I did.
And there are some movies, other movies. There are movies that I go the other way on too, where I go, oh, that's a really cool movie. And then like, you go watch it again and you're like, oh, that's, I was just kind of like recency bias, or it kind of blew me away or surprised me the first time, but it doesn't really, it doesn't really hold up to repeat things. So I think that's really interesting when that happens.
It's the show Sherlock.
It actually is the show Sherlock. Past season one, I couldn't rewatch that.
Yeah.
So yeah.
All right, well, that's our Halloween recap.
Oh, but wait. We're not done with Halloween yet.
That's right. What else did we watch for Halloween?
Well, this week we returned to a world we have explored before. We saw the original a few weeks ago, and so now we're doing the follow-up. We watched the 1935 sci-fi horror film, The Bride of Frankenstein. In this sequel, Dr. Frankenstein, who somehow survived the windmill fire and collapse, is forced by another mad scientist to create a mate for his monster, who also somehow survived the windmill fire and collapse. Returning to the franchise are Karloff, as he is credited. I love that he's one name, like Cher.
That's right, just a single name.
Karloff. Boris Karloff as the monster. Colin Clive as Dr. Frankenstein. Dwight Fry, who played Fritz in Frankenstein, is back, recast as another character. He plays Carl in this. And new to this franchise in this movie are Ernest Thesinger as Dr. Pretorius, Una O'Connor as Minnie, and Elsa Lanchester as Mary Shelley and the Bride. She played them both.
That's awesome.
I didn't even realize it till I did the cast list. It's so amazing. Like its predecessor, this movie was directed by James Whale, and it was written by John L. Balderston, with a new collaborator for this film, William Hurlbut, who they adapted this from the novel by Mary Shelley, who is credited as Mary Shelley and not Mrs. Percy Shelley, was in the original. And also, I thought it was interesting, William Hurlbut is from Belvidere, Illinois, which is not terribly far from where I grew up. And Belvidere, Illinois is also where they filmed part of a movie we've watched for this podcast, Road to Perdition.
Nice.
A lot of the old-timey downtown kind of area stuff was filmed in Belvidere because it still looks like a very old Depression era town.
That's a cool movie fact and like personal connection to have.
Yeah,
like, just to know that place and be like, hey, look.
There are a few times where movies were shot in the area where I was from, and it was always like a very, very big deal. It didn't matter if that movie was good or bad. Everyone from the area went to see that movie, was very excited, told everybody we knew, oh, they came and filmed around our hometown. Michelle Pfeiffer stayed at a like right outside of our hometown, and when she was filming a movie up there one time, and it was like this very big deal.
That's cool.
But yeah, and they did film Road to Perdition. I was not living up there at the time, but it was like news that like, oh, Tom Hanks and Paul Newman are in like small town Illinois, and it's very very wild.
Go check them out while they're filming.
Yeah, go bother them.
Yeah.
Anyway, I found some of the casting really interesting, particularly the Dwight Fry. Poor Dwight Fry. He gets killed again.
He's always playing these murderous characters.
Yes, these terrible people who just meet these horrible ends at the hands of monsters. As we discussed, he is Renfield in the Dracula movie as well. Like, he's very much in this universe as that guy.
It's kind of fitting that
he found a niche.
He's playing the same character, the same role, in a way.
He's a little bit typecast.
Sure.
But also, Elsa Lanchester, I thought that was a fascinating bit of casting where she played Mary Shelley at the beginning of the movie and then was playing the bride later. But it also kind of infuriated me that they missed the opportunity to have, like, Boris Karloff playing her husband at the beginning of the movie. Like, that would have been really, like, if you're going to do this, like...
Maybe it would have given it away.
Maybe it would.
Like, this big guy.
It could. Yeah. He would have probably been better as, like, Lord Byron was there.
But I didn't realize, like, that's very cool.
Oh, I didn't either. I thought it was great.
She plays the same character. And this whole movie, like, they're really given... They stepped up and they gave her the credit that they didn't in the first movie.
Yeah, we talked about that during Frankenstein, just how bizarre that was. To credit, you know, and it's sort
credit
of like
the husband.
Maybe that was a style of the time that the book was written in, that it was just sort of like an old holdover of trying to be as zeroed in on the very original, like the first edition. This would be, but it all just seemed wrong. Like, it's Mary Shelley's book. This is the singular celebrity. I'm not saying this is all she was as a person. Her single celebrity claim to fame was this book, which is like the mother of all science fiction, or the mother of all modern horror, or whatever.
Right. And then you're
know,
just gonna,
and it's just sort of like away. Oh, well, let's make sure her husband gets proper credit for you know, just so weird.
Modern Prometheus, written by the wife of some
the
guy.
Wife of some dude.
So infuriating.
I also wanted to point out that actress, Elsa Lanchester, she went on to be in, I mean, she acted up until like 1980. She had a long career. She's very young in this.
Yes.
But she plays the nanny in Mary Poppins, who is leaving at the very beginning of the movie, is fed up with those monstrous children. And it's like, wow, she is always just running away from horrific monsters because those children are terrible at the beginning of that movie. Yeah. I thought that was very interesting. A lot of her stuff was television and some movies that I didn't really recognize. But Mary Poppins. I love Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm. Maybe like the greatest Disney movie, my opinion, of all time. Like,
that's valid.
To be a part of that and to be a part of this, which is in this sort of canon of the most classic monster movies, it's like, that's a couple in a good career on paper anyway, to have two high points like that, even if they're smaller roles, I think is great. I think it's a really cool achievement. Yeah.
She worked a long time. She had some steady work, and
she was a working actor. Yeah, she had a career.
It's great.
Which is great. But I want to start with this and ask you, because you and I did not care for Frankenstein a few weeks ago. What did you think of this? What did you think of the sequel? Was there any redemption in this, or was this just as big a slog for you?
I like this so much better.
All right.
I don't know how you feel about it, but I enjoyed this movie. Like, this was just, this felt like a movie as opposed to the other one.
I agree. I went past, like, this is just an improvement, and I legitimately had fun with this movie. I think there were parts that maybe weren't meant to be silly that did come off as very silly to me, but I enjoyed that as part of the film experience.
Right.
And there were parts that were, there were kills in this movie that were legitimately horrific and graphic, and I was like surprised that they were in here for the time.
Well, like when he's in the sewer and underneath the
under the
windmill. Burnt down windmill. Yeah. That's a pretty creepy shot.
He brutally just murders that guy, and then he throws an old woman down there, and they show it. They show her, like, landing. I mean, it's a dummy, of course, but... And
it's still, like, a dead body on screen.
Also, a plus for me is an obvious dummy, and this movie is full of them. And yes. I think that is always that will never not make me laugh, to see an obvious dummy.
Between cuts there.
Yes. When he throws... Dwight Fry off the tower at the end of this. Mm-hmm. And he falls down and you don't see him. And then he picks up. I mean, it's the most obvious. It's like a scarecrow. And he chucks it off. I laughed so hard at that. But also, like, just the idea that they are portraying, in 1935, portraying a monster throwing a man off a tower to his death. And really showing that. It's shocking.
It's pretty dramatic for the time.
But I'm with you. This was a big step up for me in the Universal monster movies that I've seen. I've seen The Wolfman. I've seen Frankenstein now. I saw Dracula a long time ago. I think most of them are fine, but I wouldn't really like rush to watch any of them again. But this movie, I think, was far more entertaining. I really had a good time with this. And it
had like a coherent plot.
Yes, it did. It had
some stakes.
It had some fun characters. I think Dr. Pretorius is an amazing character. I loved every time he was on screen. Mm-hmm. This very obvious, by today's standards, gay gentleman who's also insane.
What?
Just sort of even spiraling into deeper madness throughout the course of the film.
Right. He's like a devious mastermind.
Yes. And that actor played him incredibly well.
Mm-hmm. It's camp in a good way.
It is camp. I think at the time, maybe it wasn't intended to be camp, but I think it plays that way. And just like The Dummy, it's not intended to make me laugh, but it all makes it a more entertaining experience.
It's all part of the fun, and it's a very theater experience.
Yes.
And that's like those over-the-top villains like
for sure.
Cousteau and Beauty and the Beast and stuff like that.
They're
just so over-the-top. Like a Bond villain
kind of thing. But that actor, Ernest Thesinger, in his IMDb trivia, I thought this was funny because I didn't know what this was. It said that he and a woman were in what was widely thought to be or known to be a lavender marriage. And I did not know what that was. I had a suspicion of what that was. But essentially, like, yes, these were two gay people who had a beard marriage kind of thing. And then they just sort of, it was an arrangement for people to leave them alone. And then they would just go and have, you know, whatever relationships they wanted to have with other people. And I just thought that was like, oh, that's a really interesting thing. Especially when you read like, oh yeah, everybody knew, nobody cared. Like, and this guy was probably a theater actor and he's a very sort of like flamboyant older gentleman. It's just one of those things that like read to me is like, oh yes, this guy's like obviously gay.
It's like, obvious, but like
obvious, you know, today.
Yes.
Maybe not at the time. Anyway, I think all of every bit of that, this very theatrical gentleman, came through in this character of Dr. Pretorius. Great name, by the way. And yes, I made female anatomy jokes while watching this last night.
Oh, you're not going to say it on the podcast, yes, but you'll say it.
Dr. Clitorius, we can't find him. And we can make all of these jokes. But I think it was a great name. I think he was a great character. I think they surrounded him with great special effects of the tiny people.
I thought that was amazing.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the effects of this movie and how I think they were crazy ahead of their time.
I made a joke earlier in the movie. I was like, ooh, they're going to have intense CGI for this monster. and then they show his little experiments, and he's created these shrunk down little people. He's
created tiny people in jars, yes.
And, you know, you can tell they're plastered onto the jar. Like I don't know how exactly they do it, but the films have been resized.
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of rear projection. Mm-hmm. There is probably something done with mirrors at some point. But he also is able to interact with them. Like, he picks up the little king and carries him. And these things, I'm sitting here genuinely going, and I'm not, it's not hard to outsmart me. Like, but I'm sitting here going, it's 100 years later. I don't know how they're doing some of this stuff. And it genuinely impressed me. I really thought it was a great set of trick photography and special effects. All done. You know, this isn't rotoscoped. This isn't interacting with animation. They didn't paint this on the cells. Like, this is all in-camera special effects. And I think it's wonderful.
I imagined that they spliced it together somehow, but I couldn't figure out how.
Because you think you would see the line or... Yeah.
It's really clever. And, like, I can just imagine... sitting in this audience in like the 20s or whenever
in
this
35
came out,
is blew people's minds. I'm
all
sure.
Dressed up to go to the theater, and then you see this and you're like,
what is going on? Yeah.
How have we invented little people? Someone get to the bottom of this, because I don't have Google.
Who's that tiny ballerina? I want her in my next picture. Yeah. It's
really cool.
It's a really great sequence. And if you haven't seen the movie, he's showing Dr. Frankenstein, look, I can create life too. I've made them. And he's talking about them like being like cultures, like small samples of people.
Sure.
But I also like that he obviously took the time to make them tiny clothes that fit them.
It's and so nice of
here's
him.
Your tiny little throne, King, and all of these things. And he discourages sexual harassment by right. removing the king.
All right, King, stop catcalling.
Stop harassing the queen. Yes.
He puts on his construction worker outfit.
Hey, baby!
What's up? Another thing about this character, though, I can't remember his real name because I'm just thinking Dr. Clitoris now.
Pretorius.
Dr. Pretorius.
It rhymes.
Sure.
Dolores Pretorius.
I find him interesting as he relates to Frankenstein, because, like, Frankenstein almost, this is interesting, okay, because the plot is, like, totally divorced from the book.
Oh,
and
yeah.
This is, like, a brand new original plot, but, like.
The book, I believe, does have something about forcing Frankenstein to build a mate for the monster.
I know he makes a mate for the monster. I thought it was voluntary, though. I could be wrong.
It's
haven't read it.
My memory of it is so shaky. I was a kid when I read it. But the bones of this is from the Mary Shelley novel. Like,
right.
There is the aspect of, I'll make someone so you're not lonely anymore.
Mm-hmm. And I like that they've made it. Frankenstein survived his fall from the last movie. We're retconning that.
Speaking of Sherlock, it is very much like the Conan Doyle.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm going to kill off the character. And then he's like, no, wait, I'm just kidding.
I need more money. Bring it back.
They never address how he survives anything.
But this is cool because it's like, he almost died. And then, like, he almost spiritually died. Like, his desire to create life.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, I'm not going to do that anymore. Until the scientist shows up and he's like trying to make him. He's like, no, we gotta. Like,
he's like, partner with me. Help me out, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's conflicted in this, and I can buy his kind of character changes and how his motivation changes. Whereas in the last movie, it's just whatever they needed for the scene.
Yeah,
They're going to have him play whatever way. But like this, he's back and forth because of external reasons, which makes sense.
Yeah, they give the character of Frankenstein actually consistency in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense of why he is where he is. You know, they need him to, okay, just want to be married, which is also the other half of the meaning of Bride of Frankenstein is like, He's getting married. Frankenstein, you know, and she's in danger by the end of this as well. So it is, you know, you think of the Bride of Frankenstein is the creature they build, but also it's the literal bride of literal Frankenstein in this, yes. Which I think is a nice little like,
it's like a
double entendre kind of thing. But it's a lot. This is a lot more even of a script. It's a lot better script than I think the original Frankenstein. The story makes sense. There's character development in, you know, he meets the blind man in the forest. And there's this weird part in the middle of the movie that's all about the friendship between this monster and this blind man.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of doesn't have a lot to do with the rest of the movie. It, outside of developing this idea that he can never have a companion who's in the human world. But also it's just, but that's the point, is it just is this character development. Like, the script takes time to show the growth of this character.
Can I say I loved that scene because it was like, it's an original thing to this movie, but it's embodying what I think the message of the original story is about how, oh, someone who can't see, we're judging this monster based on how he looks, but inside he's a sweet person.
Right.
And so someone who can't see, someone who can't judge based on looks, can befriend him, can aid in loneliness and teach him. And then I was like, I know the monster's not going to have a happy ending in this, but I genuinely, I was so sad.
Nor will the blind man, you know, like, and it's similar to the idea in the first Frankenstein of the little girl. She's also not judging him. She's a child. She's innocent.
Yes.
And, you know, that ends tragically. Like, this idea that I've created a man. Oh, guess what? It's not a man because he doesn't fit into the world of man. People who don't judge him, he doesn't fit in with them either. As hard as he tries, it's just different.
He doesn't quite understand
it's the societal norms. He's too strong. He's too clumsy. He's too whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I like that, unlike the little girl scene, it just plays as a horrific accident that happens. It doesn't really reinforce that character development. And here it's a big chunk of the movie where they've spent time there. It doesn't tell you how long it's been, but it's obvious he's been there for a little while. He's learning to speak. They're becoming friends.
Yeah, it's a time skip.
And it just sort of reinforces this idea of like, oh, maybe he can live this kind of nice life out there. And of course not. You know, when the prejudices of the outside world show up, that's when everything goes to hell.
It's not the monster ruining this moment.
Right.
It's the outside world coming in and telling them how they should behave. Or, oh, he's a monster. You don't know?
Which brings us to, do we want to talk about the Jesus metaphor of it all?
You can go for that, because I don't fully see that.
We made a joke about it when he was, quote-unquote, on the cross.
Yeah.
But it made me kind of think things through, however intentional or not this was. The monster is made of unnatural means, just like Jesus. He's made by a man playing God. He's not God, but Son of God. He's more than a man. He doesn't quite fit into the world of men. There is little things like when he's eating with the blind man, it's bread and wine. That's communion. And
those cigars that Jesus always smokes.
I do like that Frankenstein parties a little bit in this
one. It's pretty fun.
He likes drinking.
I bum a smoke?
He does say that, and it's great.
It's ridiculous.
But let's see, what else do I got here? The old man, the blind man, Jesus healed the blind man. It's a miracle. It's not quite the same, but it's adjacent, I would say.
Loneliness.
Yes. Just the crosses. There's, he's tied to the big stick, and it's cross-like. And then when he is in the blind man's cabin, and he lays down to go to sleep. The lights go down, but there's still a light shining on the cross mm-hmm. above the bed. When he goes down in the cemetery, there's a giant crucifix leading into the crypt. There's religious imagery, and I can't speak to intent. It doesn't feel unintentional. Mm-hmm. It feels very much like they are trying to draw a line between Frankenstein's monster and Jesus Christ. Not in every single way. He's not the salvation of man, but just this idea of, in the same way of like a later version of Frankenstein is the Incredible Hulk. And a lot of the Marvel heroes, Silver Surfer, the X-Men, the idea of being these outcasts from society who have sacrificed a lot and are still sort of cast out even when they're saving people, and just how lonely that is. And yeah. I think that aspect of Jesus, that he was an outcast, he had an entourage, but he was still an outcast. He performed miracles, and the political powers of the day hated that. And the church elders hated that. He was a member of a church, and he was working for their God, and that turned the higher... It's just the paradox of the people who should cheer the hardest for you hate you for what you are.
The people you're saving.
And I think it's that aspect of like the Jesus story, whether you take it as a story, you take it as reality, it's great mythology. And I think that's why it applies so widely across pop culture in a story like this that has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. This isn't a Christian movie. You know what I mean?
But you're right.
That aspect of the monomyth and that aspect of it, of being like this lonely outcast. And I think people forget that about like the story of Jesus, is that he was this lonely outcast. You know what I mean? In society. And I think that part of it, I'm probably putting some of my own baggage on this, but there's so much of it here that it just feels like they have to be leaning into this at least a little bit on purpose.
Well, I see what you're saying. I didn't notice the... you said there was a cross leading into the graveyard.
Into when he goes underground.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that, but I did notice... when he's going to sleep, when it is the prayer scene.
When the light of the entire set changes to focus on the, like...
I loved that. I thought that was a really nice, like...
No, I did too, but you can tell when they turn that light on, because the exposure of the entire frame, like, shifts, and then all the lights start going down. It's just one of those old film things that I think is charming.
I was confused on how they did that. I thought they... kind of blacked out the rest.
I think they...
Instead of turning off the lights, they, like, faded on the film somehow in editing. I thought that's what they did.
But they could have shifted the exposure and had a single light on
and just on leave that the cross
more
unexposed.
intense thing. But yeah, you can tell right before that if you watch it. And this could be part of the transfer that just happened to be at that moment. But right before the lights start going down, the whole tone, like the whole lighting tone of that room shifts. And it's because I think they turned a light on
to
that
focus
cross.
On the cross. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it just stood out to me because I'm always, you know, I think especially since they showed those tiny people. I spent a lot of this movie going like,
how
are they doing this? How are they, you know, and a lot of it. You know, it's very obvious, like, again, I have to applaud, like, the Frankenstein makeup and Boris Karloff's performance as that monster under all that makeup to still be able to be a tragic, and I think he's far more tragic in this movie than in Frankenstein.
Yeah, and that's what he's meant to be. Yes. I love this portrayal of Frankenstein so much more.
Yeah.
Neither of these movies are accurate to the original story at all.
Not really, no.
But I really, this one feels like the heart is there. Someone read the book. They really enjoyed it and understood the meaning, and Universal Pictures was like, we need more Frankenstein.
Right.
And they were like, all right, let's do this right. Let's honor Mary Shelley. Let's educate the audience in the beginning that she is the one who wrote this.
That's a great point. When we talked about how they credited her, we should have talked about this right from the beginning. But like, yes, they go past just making sure her name is on here.
It's not just written.
And this is like the first meta horror movie, because it opens with Mary Shelley telling this story to her husband and Lord Byron.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was weird, A, because they never come back to it. They don't close the movie.
It should have been a bookend.
It should have been a bookend.
But yeah.
But it was also very much, like you say, like making sure people know, like, yes, this is Mary Shelley's story. She's there with her husband, and her husband's like, ooh, tell us the rest of the story, Mary. Mm-hmm. Like, they're making sure, and it makes me wonder, like, did they get backlash from not crediting her properly? Or was it something like, after the fact, they go, you know what, we really should have said Mary Shelley. Let's make sure we correct this.
I think it's that second, because I don't think they had backlash in the same way
back it was then. A lot slower. Like,
yeah. in a decade's time, they'll figure it out. But I think most audiences and most people
back then... What does tic-tac-toe cancel Frankenstein mean?
Tic-tac-toe. God.
So reading a postcard.
No, I really think most people just didn't know who Mary Shelley was back then.
Possibly. Frankenstein was a huge book. And by that time, it had been out for 100 years. It was already a certified classic. But
The movie-going audience who hadn't read the book.
Possibly, yeah.
I don't know what
I'm not suggesting that backlash looked the same as it did now, but I think it's entirely possible. They got a few letters that were like, you know, I think it was kind of shitty that you didn't, mm-hmm. you know, if you were like a, you know, it's not as though there were no young women authors who went and saw Frankenstein and were like, hey, wait a minute. Even if I write a book, they're just going to credit my stupid husband, mm-hmm. you know, like.
Or it could have been the estate of the Shelleys.
It could have been, yeah.
I'm not sure. But I love the wording of that whole scene where they're like, everything comes back to explaining to the audience who these people are.
Oh, they do the flashbacks to the first movie.
Oh, I didn't even mean that. That is great, like the little clip show they do. But I'm talking like,
previously on Frankenstein. Yes. Like.
They're like, Mary Shelley, how could a young woman like you, married to a poet, ever write this scary, scary book? Well, let me tell you about
it.
Like, it's over the top, but it's educational, and it's... I think it's paying respect, and I love that.
It's
I
like
love
the, that they the write it old, all. Like, variety show... like Christmas specials,
mm-hmm.
where they'd be like, oh, look, it's Bing Crosby. Come on in. You know, like, it just was like, yeah, we all see who it is. Like, explaining everything as they go. But yeah, I thought it was really interesting. And this is the kind of thing when I watch a movie, I know we've talked about this in some ways before. I don't remember how deep we've gone on it, but like when you watch a movie from this time period, and in my mind, like, Scream created meta horror, mm-hmm. and then you watch a movie that predates Scream by 60 years, and it's a person fully telling the story and acknowledging this is a story. I'm telling you a fictional story right now.
Yes. And then she plays a character. And then she
plays a character
that is
in
so
it,
symbolic.
And it is just sort of like, oh my God. You know, this is amazing. This is amazing mm-hmm. that meta horror existed almost at the very beginning of horror.
Yeah.
Like and they were already, I mean, film, this wasn't the beginning of film, but it was sort of the beginning of the talkie era. And just the idea of like the very beginnings of the movie industry, people experimenting already with like how to tell stories in this format.
Yeah, they're trying new stuff.
By our standards, this is very primitive meta commentary, but it's also like they had no roadmap for it. They were just sort of starting out with this. And I think it's incredible. And I got to give this movie huge credit for that.
Yeah, I think that was really clever.
And for deviating from the book in this movie in a good way, I'm going to say. Not that the book is bad, but like it's like they're already off the rails from what the book was from the first movie. And in this movie, they're like, okay, fine. We'll sort of stay off the rails from it, but let's do the work on the character this time. There's a couple points where Frankenstein's monster has a single tear roll down his cheek, and it is a legitimately earned, honest, and emotional moment. I felt so bad for that character in that moment. For as much as I laughed, and we sort of MST3K'd certain portions of this movie for being silly and campy, but there were legitimate emotional moments. The blind man, when his house is burning down, talk about biblical. This guy is like Job, you know, like the whole world is shitting on this poor old blind man who just tried to be kind to somebody.
And even just like when he finds the blind man and he's listening to the music.
Oh, the music is great.
So sweet. Yes. Like just that quiet, slow scene where you understand what's happening without it being told to you. He likes the music.
Yeah, the music, you know, it soothes the savage beast, you know, kind of thing. And it's one of those things that sort of, I think, became sort of a hallmark of the character. You know, we see it in Young Frankenstein. It's kind of parodied. The blind man stuff is parodied, but also like the music, music part of it is part of that plot. And I don't mean to like, yes, I know Young Frankenstein is a parody of this, but it still is like calling on some very big things that are rooted in the Frankenstein movie mythos, I think.
And that's cool.
I think it's very cool. Yeah.
I need to rewatch it because it's been a long time.
It's still so great. Yeah.
And I hadn't seen the Frankenstein movies.
Right, then, right.
So now I have.
Gene Hackman plays the blind man and he's like missing the soup bowl and like pouring it in his lap and stuff. It's so great.
Some good sight gags.
But yeah, and the whole idea of like Frankenstein being afraid of fire, I think it's kind of rooted here, and I think that's great. And you know, fire bad again, great parody when Phil Hartman played Frankenstein on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And stuff like that. And I just...
Because it is silly. The whole story is silly. The parts of what they're trying to be serious is silly. But, like, there's also a lot of comedy. Like...
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you notice that? Like, the town busybody who's always...
Oh,
like,
yeah. The lady. She's, like, running around... you know, in everybody's business, and oh, nobody listens to me, and you can tell she's like the town gossip and stuff like that. The Bürgermeister who with the terrible like fake mustache, like you know, and that and then just everything about them. They catch Frankenstein, and literally 5 minutes later he's breaking out.
He's gone.
And he breaks out in the middle of him like basically giving a press conference to the town. Of like, we got him, don't worry. And then he comes running.
The comedic timing of that is, it's intentional. Like, I think, at least.
And then I think also the Dr. Pretorius being, there's like a running gag of like, oh, gin, it's my one weakness. And then later on, it's like, oh, cigars, that's my one weakness. Like,
I didn't even catch that.
Like, it's just like he has all these vices. But he's always claiming that it's just the one. And that he's just kind of... It makes you wonder, like, how silly did this play in 1935? Was this a silly character when he's in the crypt with his little Jeffrey Dahmer-style altar and, like, just laughing maniacally at nothing? Like, it's silly. But also,
you
like...
You think audiences were terrified?
I don't know. I don't know if they were terrified or they were just like, oh my God, this guy's really crazy. In the same way that, like, 20 years ago when we watched Silence of the Lambs and we're like, oh my God, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. And then you go, oh, well, you know, it's not really that out of bounds compared to what we see now.
Still
you
pretty
know.
Crazy.
It
right?
still is, but for yeah. sure. Yeah. But, yeah, I think there is some stuff that plays very silly in this movie, but they balance it, intentional or not, it's balanced with the things that play horrifically, and I think there are some genuinely scary things in this movie, is far more than the first one. Mm-hmm. You know, when he runs after the shepherd girl. It's like, oh my God, where is this going? You know, like
it's gonna brutally hurt her.
It really like that was a terrifying moment because I didn't know, you know, how graphic is this gonna get, and that's like mm-hmm. basically a child, and like some of that stuff was I think really intense, and I can't imagine in 1935 how intense something like that.
Oh, there was panic in the streets.
There probably was. I mean. This is horror. I mean, horror has always been, like, kind of controversial. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Be interested to see what the public response was to this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I didn't look that up, but I wonder if I should have. But, because that is just something you have to wonder about.
Mm-hmm. Like,
what else you got?
I'm really not sure. Like... This isn't a super deep movie. Like, it's... I think it's a lot better than the first one. And it's of its time. And I like looking at it through that lens. But, like, there's not a whole lot of deep dive stuff that I really could pick out from here. Just like...
No. I mean, we talk about the special effects being ahead of their time.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly to... The first one, I think the sets and the set designs and the way the camera moves around them is second to none. Grade A. Like, by today's standards, I think that would be amazingly... This movie is amazingly well shot.
Yeah.
Like, the big, like, common areas of, like, the castle and stuff like that, that are these big, wide open spaces. And when people come in, the camera, like, it'll be a wide shot of it. And people will come in, and as they're moving, the camera starts, like, kind of pivoting. It's just, it's a very interesting series of shots. And I think they do it so, so well. I think James Whale and whoever his director of photography was, I think they set up some great shots in this.
I think the first shot where we're meeting Mary Shelley, mm-hmm. and there's, like, the dog walker, and we're panning in.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
She's going out. It's this very dynamic,
yeah,
zoom in kind of feel.
That kind of thing that they do in these movies is great. Like the slow zoom into a like a big space down to a person or a set of characters. I want to just talk about the bride a little bit before we get out. The bride herself.
I mean, she's barely in it.
She is barely in it, but I think she carries so much weight in it. You know, she's the. Not only the kind of, what do you call that? The MacGuffin of the movie.
The thing they're searching for.
The thing they're trying to get. But also, like, her reaction to Frankenstein's monster. Her reaction to the monster is like, oh, he's disgusting. It's like, you're disgusting too. Like, you were literally made for each other. And that even... she rejects the monster is crazy tragic. And her reaction to him, her hissing when he's about to blow up the castle, and I just have to shout out again the makeup, the iconic hairstyle.
She looks so cool.
It's amazing. She's great. It is one of the great, I mean, we've all seen this character before, whether you've seen the movie or not. But I think in watching the movie and watching how you get there, you gain an appreciation for this character. It just seems mm-hmm. like you get an extra level. Like, you earned it. You earned getting there and seeing this hideous woman come
out. It's a nice payoff.
Yes. And the way, like, she, when she first stands up and they're, like pulling her dress, you know, like fanning it out and stuff like, and she's sort of, like, standing up. It's like the reveal, the big sort of, like, money shot reveal of mm-hmm. the Bride of Frankenstein. I think it's great. I think it's a great shot. And I think that actress, I think she's, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, she's playing somebody hideous because look at the scars on her face and look at the weird hair, but she's really actually like very pretty. And in,
of course,
in the context of like the Gothic castle and the lighting, it just all works. And I think it's just one of those things that is, it's kind of a powerful character moment for her and for the hour of watching this monster try to become human and try to form a connection. And it just makes the tragedy of that so much better. Mm-hmm. Instead of, well, we failed to make you a mate, have them be like, oh, we did it. And actually, she hates you too. Like, that is so much more tragic. You know what I mean?
That's terrible.
It really is. But it's fitting for the story they're telling. And I kind of love the terrible, tragic ending of this. Like, I think it's great. I think it's a wonderful sort of closure on this idea of, like, you know, if sort of like Frankenstein's monster just becoming like a giant nihilist and be like, well, fuck it. I'm pulling the lever.
You know, your first time you get friend zoned, it does feel like it you want to.
It stings. Yeah.
You want to burn the whole castle down.
Oh my God. He's the first incel.
Oh my God.
He's the first. To hell with it. I'm a nice guy. Me, nice guy.
What wrong? Oh, that's great. I'm interested because I hear what you're saying, but I did feel like it was, I felt an anti-climax, like in that I expected more of the Bride of Frankenstein. Like, I thought she was gonna be this big character, and then like
right.
I thought she was gonna do something. I thought set off a potential next movie or what. I thought the third act was going to be like fighting with her, like this big struggle.
Interesting.
And so that was my expectation. And then she just rejected him and instantly died. And like, I understood like, oh, that's what they're going for. That's the tragedy. But I was like, thought she was this iconic character in horror. What? She's got 4 minutes of screen time. That was a letdown.
I mean, but does minutes of screen time equal importance?
No, but in the end, she doesn't do anything.
She does the most important thing, is she rejects him and seals his fate as the unlovable monster.
Sure, I don't know. I felt like there was more story after that we were missing
out. I think you've been conditioned by Marvel movies where nobody is introduced that doesn't end up as part of the greater ongoing universe. You know what? Everybody likes that Agent Coulson guy. Let's put him in every movie. And then let's give him a TV show. And then let's... You know what I mean? Like, I'm just...
That's not what I was expecting.
I'm not trying to use that as a strike against you. I'm saying modern movies and modern franchises, and more importantly, modern shared universes. This is the granddaddy of shared universes. Like, that is the mechanics of them. It's like the American Indians and the buffalo. No part goes to waste. Everything is used. Everything is gotten maximum usage out of. Frankly, I don't think mainstream movies like to do big downer. And this is just such a different kind of movie than what we see in the mainstream today.
That's not what I'm talking about, though. That's a different point. Like, I'm just saying...
You're saying people aren't put in... Someone in a movie that it's named for them, and sort of, they become built up as this big character, you're saying that they should be in the movie more.
Well, that's just what I expected. I thought she was going to show up halfway through the movie and be one of the main characters. I mean,
technically, she kind of did.
then she was murdered. I don't know. I'm having trouble saying. I feel like you're arguing a different point, though. Like, I don't want her to get a spin-off movie. This expanded universe.
No, but I'm just saying, like,
I thought she would have her own agency, be her own character. She only exists as a point in the original monster's character arc, which I guess is her point in the movie, in the book, I mean, and like that is what she was meant to be, but I just, the movie built her into something different than I expected.
I'm going to argue that she has the most agency of almost anyone in this movie. I think she is built specifically to be a mate to the monster. That is her one purpose, and she rejects that. She has ultimate agency. She's like, no, that's who you want me to be. That's not who I am. And you can say that from a plot device, oh, she's only a plot device, but like, that's a very important plot device, and I think that's a very powerful plot device, is someone who goes against the plot. I mean, that's the plot of this whole story is getting her to mate with Frankenstein. Pretorius, what he wants to do is create an entire new species.
Yeah.
That's his motivation behind it. The monster wants, he wants a mate because he's lonely. Frankenstein is just trying to get his wife back. So everybody's conspiring to make this living being who they're essentially going to sex traffic to Frankenstein's monster, and she rejects that. I don't think there's anything more empowering than that as far as a character, whether she's on screen for half the movie or 5 minutes.
I can see how that would be impactful, but it just wasn't watching it. It went by so fast, I didn't even realize what was happening until he's telling Frankenstein to go, and then he's tearing down the whole castle.
Great ending, by
the way. I don't know. Like, it just went by so fast.
You just wanted more.
I just don't get it. She's an extra in the movie, almost, it feels like. With what screen time we got. I understand the importance of it.
I just don't equate screen time with importance to a plot. I think there's
I don't either.
What's the Tarantino thing he told that woman? I reject your hypothesis or something like that, when someone asked him like, why didn't you give Margot Robbie more lines? It's like, she's kind of the pivotal character in the alternate history. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, she's very important to the plot and she plays her part very well. I'm sorry she wasn't in it enough for you. But like, you know, the Sharon Tate character, it all kind of hinges on whether or not she lives or dies, if you're going to lay that out that way. Anyway, that's a different movie. The point being, like, I think you can have a great character with very little screen time, and that character can have a huge impact on the movie. And I think that's what she did here. If someone complains that that didn't do it for them, that it sort of, I get what you mean, because it is only a couple minutes.
It's more like, I didn't expect that.
Sure.
For the title character of this movie. I understand, like, a supporting role, a minor character having a big impact. Like, I've seen that before.
Yeah.
But, like, not when their name is the movie and it's like, oh, this is going to be, like, a really big deal.
Subverted expectations. Yeah. I get it.
Sure. I don't know.
I don't know what to tell you. I think there is something of a modern sensibility versus, like, an old Hollywood kind of thing, because I think that's just a thing that we don't do anymore. And I'm not using that as a dig against you or against modern movies. I just think that's sort of I mean, also around this time is a movie called The Maltese Falcon. Everybody's looking for The Maltese Falcon. What is, I got to find The Maltese Falcon. It's barely in the movie. And when they get to the end of it, it's nothing. The whole thing is like a fake they've been chasing around, and it's anticlimactic, but it's also like, yeah, okay, I was still entertained by this movie. And
but you know, it seems like that realization could have something. I felt like this ending came and went, and I just didn't expect. I was still waiting for Act 3, and I never got it. Even though
it comes right at the end. It's in the light. Last 10 seconds when the whole castle explodes.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, that's the resolution. Yeah. No, I'm not going to argue with you if it didn't do it for you. It didn't do it for you. I just, you know, I think it's interesting that I'm just trying to explore, like, the different reactions to it is all.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It just caught me off guard. That's all.
Fair. I think that's one of those things that's cool about watching old movies where they don't necessarily make movies like this anymore. And when you see things like that, like how they use a character or how they get, like, so a lot of these movies, like this one, I will give you this. Like, movies like this, they just end. They just get to a certain point, and then there's no, like, sitting around talking about it or reflecting on what just happened. It's just over. You know? And, like, that is crazy jarring.
It's almost like you're explaining it and you're like, this is how the story ends, and I'm like, oh, that's a impactful resolution, it makes sense, it's right. It's there, but like, we didn't get shown it, like, right. In the direction there wasn't like, oh, we're gonna have some speech about this, we're gonna focus on the characters, like, actual thing.
It's an interesting way to just go, look, we showed you everything that was in our movie, we said everything we had to say through the actions of the characters and whatnot, we don't need to recap this, you guys just watch the movie. And like, I watched a Hitchcock movie a few months ago called North by Northwest, and it's really great. It's this great sort of espionage thriller. It's very cool. And the big action set piece takes place on the top of Mount Rushmore. And it's just very tense, very, you know, who's going to fall off the edge, this and that. And it gets over and it's a smash cut to the lead and his new wife. They just got married and they're like, we're going on our honeymoon. The end. That, and the movie just goes from high action, everybody on the edge of their seat watching it, to movie's over, get the fuck out of the theater. We gotta clean up. We got another audience coming in. I mean, it is literally shove you out the door at the end. And I just think that's an old style of making movies, is like, okay, we showed you everything, we don't need to recap anything, we're done, get out the door and move on to the next movie or whatever.
I think you're right, and I don't like it.
That's fair. But like, what I was saying is, I like watching old movies because that is so jarring, and you go, oh my God, they totally don't do this anymore. And this is just a completely different style of filmmaking. In the same way, like, if you start, you have the Panic at the Disco album you bought, and it's, you know, inspired by Beatles music. And if you took that and you were like, well, okay, I'm going to check out Beatles music, boom. And then you go, oh, okay, the Beatles were inspired by Elvis and by skiffle music. Let me see what that's all about. And you started working your way backwards. Every time you went backwards, you go, I don't like this, but it's kind of cool because it's a very different kind of music than anything I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And the same thing if you work backwards through like art and different art styles of the Art Deco of like the 60s, and you walked that back to like the Harlem Renaissance and things like that, you'd be seeing the trail of influence, but also every era is so starkly different than anything else you've ever seen that you would go, I like this, I like this, I don't like this, but I like that it's so fucking different than anything I've seen before. And that's what a lot of these movies, even the original Frankenstein that we watched a few weeks ago and didn't like, there were things in there where I was just like, oh my God, the cinematography of this is great. The makeup is great.
Yeah.
The body acting is great. Like, it's...
there's still good things in there.
But everything else is so wildly different, and it's jarring, and it's kind of hard to watch. And I think... I think it's interesting that you and I have these different reactions to. I think The Bride is genius, and you're like, oh, I'm glad they don't do this shit anymore. But yeah,
I liked her. It was just unexpected. I don't want the takeaway to be that I didn't like her character.
I get what you're saying, because it is just sort of like, oh, it's just over,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I did expect her to come around more in like the middle of the movie as well.
And I find it interesting how things progress, because like looking at what I've seen of like movie history, it's like, when did The Wizard of Oz come out? When was that?
Oh, it was like right around this time.
What?
It's like in the 30s, yeah. I
thought it was like the 40s, maybe 50s.
No, it's like 38, maybe.
Okay, well, all right. Well,
39.
This production feels so much like a play, because that's... We did plays, and then we moved to movies.
Yeah.
And, you know...
I think... I'll give these more credit than that, just because I think some of the shots are very cinematic, and I think this, in some ways, the acting feels like a play, mm-hmm. but I think the scope that some of these scenes are shot at feels very cinematic.
They are getting more dynamic with it. They're moving. They have more set pieces.
Not all of them. Some of them do feel like a play, like when the monster goes to like the gypsy camp,
mm-hmm.
and like murders all the people there.
Like, why not?
That very much feels like a play, because it's like a camera that's sitting still in just that one set, basically,
mm-hmm.
you know? But yeah, I'm sorry.
They're moving around more.
Yeah.
But I just think like, I look at classic Doctor Who and it's like, this feels very play-like. And granted, that's TV.
That's TV, yeah.
And they're serializing it, but that is very much what it is. And same with old Star Trek. It's like, I don't know how to fully explain it, but it's like, this feels at the same primitive level that the 30s movies are on.
Right.
But like, the movies in the 60s are further along than that.
Well, aside from like budget constraints.
Yes.
And, you know, aspect ratio, everything had to be smaller on TV. Mm-hmm. I'm going to also suggest, keep in mind that like let's say The Wizard of Oz, 1939, let's say that's about 10 years into talkies, 20 years into movies,
mm-hmm.
give or take.
Sure.
Let's average. Just call it that. Take Doctor Who, mid 60s. That's 15 to 20 years into television. Mm-hmm. So while TV and movies, I think, are similar, it is different mediums. Maybe not so much.
They had to learn the mechanics.
Maybe not so much anymore that we're making, you know, the golden age of TV. And, you know, TV is more cinematic than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. You have series like The Rehearsal. No, I'm kidding. Actually, the budget of The Rehearsal is probably insane. Akin to some movies. But watch The Rehearsal, everybody. It's so fucking good.
But like a lot of the mini series that we yes. see crop up.
I mean, Stranger like, Things, what were we talking about? Like the budget of the God, last season yeah. of Stranger Things.
Each episode's a movie.
They basically. Could have produced, you know, probably half a dozen high budget action movies, mm-hmm. like CGI heavy action movies. But like, yeah, I would say in looking at filmographies of actors in this movie this morning, I saw how many of them worked in early television, late 40s, early 50s. And it's all like Chevrolet Theater, Ford Theater. It was all these sort of like anthology. They were basically doing plays on TV. Like 12 Angry Men that we watched was basically on one of those anthology TV series in the 60s. Like
really?
Like a home theater kind of like, we're going to show you this play. And it was like this very small, a lot of times like, you know, one set. The Honeymooners, very early like sitcom. It basically had like two sets. It all took place in this apartment, in one room of a New York apartment. You know what I mean? Like, it was this,
right,
this, you know, same dynamic we see now. Hot wife, fat, stupid man. You know, like, it was the
sitcoms have not changed.
They really have not. But it's, yeah, I think there is something to the idea of, oh, they were figuring out TV. And TV is one of those things that also, like, if you ever, I'll have to see if I can still find them on YouTube. There are things of, like, the very early history of TV. Here's what we were showing on TV. And it's just weird shit because nobody really knew what to do with
they
it.
They got to fill all this
time.
Like,
we got all this time. There was sort of a culture war in, do we use this as an educational tool or do we use this as an entertainment tool? Do we use this to convey information and news and science and these kinds of things? And, you know, we all see what won out, for better or for worse. But, you know, like, early TV was weird. I mean, it just, like, people didn't know what to do with it. And I think it was, like, probably late 50s, early 60s, stuff that was on Nick at Night when I was a kid. That's when
it started.
TV started kind of coming into its own. So, Doctor Who, you know, the Brits, they're way behind us on everything.
Just kidding. Careful.
But Doctor Who was an educational show at the beginning, correct?
It was, yeah.
So, okay, right away, you know it's not getting the budget that an entertainment TV show is. Mm-hmm. It's like the PBS of England, you know what I mean? Watch that, I know I've talked about it, that Street Gang documentary about early Sesame Street, and see how much they had to fight to get a budget to make educational children's television.
Right.
So think about the BBC that was not dealing with as much money, I'm assuming, in the 60s to go, wait, you have a time-traveling, you know, phone booth and
this. It's very experimental. But
absolutely. Very kind of psychedelic experimental children's TV, which is really cool when you think about it.
Well, we'll give you five sets a season. Go ahead and set.
Right.
Eight episodes per set, and there you go. There's your season.
Star Trek, it's always, I love the idea that they were just building episodes around, well, we're on the CBS lot. Can we use the Gunsmoke set? You know, and so they would go to the Western planet, or they would go to the Nazi planet, and, you know, like,
it's pretty funny.
You know, it was just because they were there and these sets existed and they could use them and it didn't cost them anything. Mm-hmm. Like, so they would just write something for that. And it's just sort of like, I love the idea. I think we have lost something in being able to CGI whatever we want and having, you know, exorbitant budgets for a lot of TV. I think there's a real charm to the old TV that had constraints, and movies as well, that had budget constraints and had to work within them. I think that's why
they get creative.
I think that's why people like movies from like Asylum that are like the knockoff Transformers movie. Like, the joke of Asylum is like, every Asylum movie has to have a submarine scene in it because they own a submarine set. So they have to, they can use it without having to build anything. And I think that's hilarious. And also, I think that's kind of why people like sci-fi movies and stuff like that. It harkens back to like budget constraints and that you see creative solutions and workarounds for that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is fun.
We're going to have to watch some old Doctor Who, you know, just for fun, because I've never seen like the real early stuff and I want to know.
Careful, Dad.
How terrible it is.
I'm already excited. Be careful.
Now think about this. You're going to have to listen to me tell you what I think about it when it's over.
Oh, God, no. I will say, I dread your reactions. There's an ongoing joke of the amount of rock quarries that are used as sets in Doctor Who, because that's like half of the alien planets,
right,
or dramatic scenes happen just at the same rock quarry.
Yeah.
It's just, that's where they go.
Yep.
It's got a cliff. It's got everything.
Yeah.
So,
you know, you got it all at a rock quarry.
But, you know, they focus on smart storytelling.
Right.
That's again, the plaything.
Like, but I mean, like, that's also like why still today, something like the Cybermen looks so silly, because they haven't updated those designs since they made cheap costumes of the Cybermen, like, way back in the day.
They've actually updated them a lot.
Have they really?
It's interesting.
Why do they still look so terrible?
Well, I'll tell you. It is...
All right. Buckle up, everyone. I just made a huge mistake. I'm sorry.
You're welcome.
I think I made a huge mistake.
Funnily enough, the Cybermen are based on Frankenstein.
Really?
The idea...
Whoa! It all came full circle.
There's a episode from a few years ago where they go and meet Mary Shelley on the night she conceived of Frankenstein, and then a Cyberman attacks her manor.
Wait, is this one of the things where, like, them going to see her is what inspires her to write Frankenstein? Is this like a Back to the Future, Marty McFly invented rock and roll kind of thing?
Yes, but they play it off more like they're educating the audience about the themes of the Frankenstein book. But anyway, the original Cybermen, much more body horror, like there's fabric covering them and they look very mechanical and like they have a creepy walk and...
Oh, it's like the Thriller video.
Sure.
Yeah.
They take people over and then now you're a Cyberman. All your emotions have been removed and you're a part of the machine. Mm. So there's that. And then they turn them into like these super sleek, not threatening at all.
Yeah, that's
metal
what I know.
Robot
them.
Designs.
That's what I know them to be.
Yeah, that's Russell T. Davis's fault.
Okay.
2006, he redesigned them, and they've been terrible ever since.
I was waiting for the Stephen Moffat hate to come out, but I'm sure he's responsible for something
actually,
else terrible.
Actually, let me just clear the record. Season 10, which was Stephen Moffat's last season, he brought back the body horror of the Cybermen.
Really?
I'd like to make you watch that episode because it's pretty horrific. There's a man who's been half converted.
Who's the doctor then?
Peter Capaldi. There's a man begging.
I can't watch any Matt Smith after watching House of the Dragon.
That's fair. He's what's this murderous person talking to kids?
Run away from the doctor.
He's scheming something horrible. Yeah. Anyway, that's my Doctor Who rant.
All right.
I'll wrap that up.
Okay. I'm very interested in the Mary Shelley one. See, we should have done it as part of the series.
That was almost my shout out, and then I was like, Dad's going to make fun of me for this.
I mean, you're not wrong, but also,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. That's how Doctor Who and Frankenstein relate.
Well, you go. We've learned something new, and we've talked a little bit. By the way, I am only talking about my very, very primitive understanding of early TV and early movies. If anyone has any information that is better than what I knew off the top of my head, please, I would love to hear it. Because I do legitimately find this stuff really interesting.
Well, this is all our perspective and like...
Sure.
Our kind of perception of
old studio system kind of stuff and old like day player TV stuff, I think is really, really interesting. Like,
it is cool to see how this all progressed.
I love when you find like an actor who's worked. I mean, you don't really see them working now, but like if you look up an actor who was in a movie in like the 90s. And it was like some character actor who had worked in like the early days of TV. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Had this long career. And you just saw they were on every single damn TV show. You know, they just, they were under contract with like a studio. And they were just in like 4 Star Treks playing different characters. And, you know, every Western and everything. And I just think like, man, you could just constantly work. Mm-hmm. You maybe weren't famous or rich, but you could just work. And like that was somebody's job was to just go to the studio and every day they're like, okay, you're going to be over here. And that, you know, when you're done shooting this. And
have you seen the guy that he plays a bunch of dead bodies in like CSI and all of these random obscure, I think he's in a House episode, like.
Oh, that's awesome.
I gotta find his name, yeah. But like, he's in all of them.
Nobody lays still like this guy. You gotta see him.
Dude,
he's so good. You can't even see him breathing.
He shuts it off, actually.
Yeah.
It's very impressive.
Actually, like, one of these, like, Zen masters who can, like, shut his metabolism down.
He just meditates. Whoa. The entire...
That guy's good.
Shot, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, that's Bride of Frankenstein. Terry Vicroy, I hope you're satisfied that we did enjoy a Universal Monster movie. I really did enjoy this, and I would totally watch this again. I think this movie was a lot of fun on a lot of different levels.
This is what people promised that the original Frankenstein movie
is. Yes, this is the kind of thing I expected, where, like I said, like Frankenstein didn't like. The Wolfman is kind of boring. Dracula's okay. It's kind of boring too, but like this one and like Creature from the Black Lagoon, I'm gonna say like these are fun movies.
Okay. I haven't seen the Black Lagoon.
Yeah. I have seen that fairly in the last couple of years. I think it might have been on Svengoolie, which is a good place to like watch this kind of stuff if you get Svengoolie where you live.
All right.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. Terry, I hope you forgive us for not liking Frankenstein. And I hope we made up for it on this one. And that the Universal Monsters have found some redemption.
That's right.
Yeah.
Good on them.
Good on them indeed. Let's go to shout-outs. Do you have a shout-out? Do you want to make it your Doctor Who episode? I'll let you.
I do have a shout-out. It's not Doctor Who, but this is so embarrassing. It's got David Tennant, and it's written by Stephen Moffat.
Ooh.
I found there is a 1-season, 4-episode miniseries called Inside Man. And this came out September of this year, but I hadn't heard of it. And I found it. It's on Netflix. And it's the story... It's kind of got two stories going together, but the first one is a horrible, monstrous serial killer, Ted Bundy-esque, who is on death row for the murder of his wife, but he helps solve cases, almost like Sherlock okay. Holmes.
Almost like a Hannibal Lecter kind of, you know, like, yeah. Cooperating.
And he's got this very calm, he's a murderer, but he's very charming, and he's trying to do some good, as he says. He's played by
Stanley Tucci?
Yeah.
Oh, I love him.
I know, he's great. And he plays this character so well. And then there's David Tennant playing a vicar who is...
What is a vicar?
Like a priest.
Okay.
He's like the head of the church. Except he's married, so I don't know if he's the head of the church.
But it could be like an Episcopalian priest or something like that.
Something yeah. like that. And
church
he,
of England. Weird.
Through a series of unfortunate events, ends up committing a crime. And it's these two characters and their stories intersecting. It's a really,
I
really
fun I
want to
say I
watch.
Stumbled across this on Netflix the other day. I haven't watched okay. it, but like looking for something to watch.
I think it's recently uploaded on there.
Okay.
Give it a try if you can, because it's not perfect, but I mean, it sure. was such a wild, it was like a 4-hour movie. That I just sat down and binged.
Because... Well, I like David Tennant, and I am happy that he didn't get so typecast in being Doctor Who that he hasn't been able to go and do other things. Mm-hmm. Same with Matt Smith. Same with Christopher Eccleston. Capaldi, I've seen doing some other things. I don't know
some
his
more
stuff
indie work.
As much. You know, Matt Smith seems like he's doing a lot of stuff, but
he's becoming a proper
just
movie
becomes
star.
Like, yeah, because I've just watched a season of House of the Dragon, and he is, guys, I know there's a lot of people who like want to hate on that show, because Game of Thrones let them down so bad. House of the Dragon, the first season, is really, really good. And I think Matt Smith is a huge reason that it is.
I believe it.
He's so good in it. But yeah. But I like that David Tennant is, like, you know, doing other things. I think it's so easy when you play a franchise character to just, you get stuck there.
Yeah.
You know, and
that is why actors do not stay in Doctor Who for that long.
It's why
they take the role for a few years and then they move on, because otherwise they're stuck as that.
It's why the Screen Actors Guild demands that you get paid a lot more money if you play the same character more than three times. Mm. Because it's like, you're making it harder for these actors to go on and do other things. People, so you have to compensate them now. And, you know, it's why, you know, they have to start backing up the Brinks truck when they want Jennifer Lawrence to go be in another X-Men movie that she doesn't want to do.
The Jennifer Lawrence treatment was terrible. I mean, that poor girl.
But, I think so many people get bogged down in the franchise machine now that it becomes hard to branch out and do other things. And mm-hmm. I'm glad there are a lot of actors who are kind of finding their way out of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
the navigating that.
David Tennant is doing that. And Stanley Tucci, huge plus for that movie. That guy is so great. If you've never seen, I know it's not a Stanley Tucci movie. If you've never seen Easy A, he is so, so good and so charming and funny in that. He plays her dad. I mean, she has, like, the cool parents who are, like,
okay,
legitimately fun and funny and love their kids. And it's just, they're so witty and playful that he's just, it's the most fun to watch him in that.
All right.
He's great, yeah.
Easy. I haven't seen that yet.
With Emma Stone?
I know of it, yeah.
Yeah, watch it. It's a really, really good movie.
Okay.
And Stanley Tucci, and I remember who plays the mom in that. But they're just wonderful. They're like the best part of that movie.
That's good.
Yeah. I have my shout-out. Someone I've shouted out before, but we had intended to do this closer to Halloween. But you can still find it. It is the Aquilo Halloween special. I sat in when Amy read it live on Twitch. It's really fun when they do these kind of special episodes. A lot of times Amy will go and do live readings and record the podcast episode. And, you know, you can sit there and watch her do it live and, you know, take breaks and they take questions. Her and JF take questions. I'm pretty sure the video is still up on Amy's Twitch. That's Dan Yora on Twitch.
That's but a I'm fun just, way to watch it.
It really is, because it's with a lot of, a lot of the community of listeners, and, you know, a lot of listeners of that are people that I know, you know, personally and are friends with. But either way, it's a community of fans, and it's just kind of fun to, it'd be like going to like a live show of a band you like, and you know, everybody's like there to see the band.
It's like a local band. You're all supporting.
So it's really a fun Halloween episode. It's super well written by, you know, our buddy JF, and Amy reads it so damn well, and
he does horror good.
He really does. I just finished a reread of A God in the Shed, and I'm starting Song of the Sandman again, because I got derailed from so many things this year. But
reading is difficult now.
Reading is hard for me to find
attention.
I did A God in the Shed via audiobook, and so let me additional shout out. JF's audiobooks are I don't know the gentleman who reads them right offhand, but they're really great, and it's a great way to consume JF storytelling.
Okay.
As is listening to Amy read Aquilo. So I'm just going to shout out the blanket of it is aquilo.com. You can get all the episodes there, and then you can find them on YouTube. You can find their social media stuff and follow them there. But yeah, get caught up on the episodes, and that Halloween special is really, really great. Both of them. I mean, that's the synergy of Aquilo, is both of them bring their A game
working together
to that, and it just always comes out really great. So
that's good.
Check it out. I know I've crowed about them a lot, and I'm going to continue to until you people start to just listen to me and check out Ake Willow. Great podcast. On that note, I want to thank you for listening to this episode that closes out season five.
That's right.
Our season five movies. We're doing one more. We're going to do a recap. But thank you for listening to five seasons of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rood. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility. It helps us grow the show.
That's right. And another way to help us grow the show is tell a friend. I don't know why I sang that. Tell a friend, please, about our show. Or we'll drop a building on you.
I mean,
that's one way to get someone to watch.
One way to throw a fit when you don't get your way.
That's right. Because if you reject us, we will get really upset.
We will get you.
That's right. And we've got five seasons of the show to listen to now. So chances are we've covered a movie.
We've covered a movie that you like, that you've seen. Yeah.
Just go look through the titles. If
your archive is all there, we have close to 90 episodes on there. So, yeah,
we're getting there.
Well, you'll find something you're a fan of there.
Exactly.
You know what we did? We've done Avatar: The Last Airbender episodes and Korra. So, you know, huge fan base for that. Who doesn't love the Avatar universe? Anyway, next week we are going to just recap season five. You know, we'll review what we watched. It seems like so long ago we started.
I know.
Yeah.
Stay tuned to find us remembering
what we watched. Yeah, that's a lot of every day now.
And figure out what our favorites were.
Yeah, what our least favorites were. We'll go over it. And and then we're going to take a little break.
Awesome.
So, social media, what do you got?
I've got one on the currently dying platform Twitter. You can find me at Austin N. Rood and The Who Review. Where can people find you, Dad?
I'm still begrudgingly on Twitter, at Phil Rood. You can message me there. I'm also on Mastodon. And my big one I'm just going to start throwing out is Ko-Fi. Coffee. Ko-Fi.
Yeah.
I would shout out more, but I don't know how to pronounce it. ko-fi.com/Phil Rood. I'm trying to update there a little bit more. It's mostly just graphic novel stuff. But I still check my messages on Twitter, so feel free to message me there.
And if
I'm stepping away from there less specifically because of Elon Musk and more just because it's increasingly becoming the shit show that Facebook has become, and I just don't like to use either of those platforms anymore.
It feeds off that energy. It's
there's definitely a vibe to it in the last week or two. So yeah.
Unrelated. If anyone could send us $8 so we can become verified. It's going to be a lot easier to find us.
Yeah. Yeah. Just after we get verified, look for me at Gary Oldman. That's right.
That's how we get him on the show. That's it, folks. A master plan.
Anyway, Oz, do you want to read the credits?
Yeah. We did it all ourselves.
There you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.